Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. No, it's really not too early to be thinking about April 15th and the tax deadline. It will be staring us in the face before we know it. So it's time to start sorting things out. Hopefully, you've begun putting numbers together. Joining me by phone to take your tax questions is Lance Weiss, CPA with SFW Partners, LLC. He's prepared to take your tax questions at 314-382-8255 or by email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We're also reachable through Twitter or Facebook. Lance, when we spoke late last year, the big question was all about that fiscal cliff and debt ceiling talk and the shadow they had cast over tax matters. Well, here we are a few days before March 1st, the sequester and all the rest of that. Are some of those 2012 tax issues still in limbo?
Well, the 2012 tax issues have pretty much been all nailed down now. What we are waiting for a number of our clients and a lot of the taxpayers out there is that the IRS isn't quite ready to receive all the forms yet electronically that changed because of that late last-minute tax law. So if you're trying to claim a general business credit or some of the new market type tax credits that are out there, and primarily those are going to be your business related returns, the IRS is not ready yet to accept those. And it's really only been a few weeks that they've been able to accept really any return electronically. So the filing season was delayed, you know, by a good 2 or 3 weeks this year.
But the deadline remains the same.
Yeah, they didn't extend back the April 15th due date. That stayed the same. But what it'll do, the clients that we have who would have already received their refunds by now, they will have to wait. You know, for some of them, it'll be later in February and maybe even early March before they get their refunds back electronically.
And that will apply to everyone down the line, those who have not yet filed?
Well, now the ones who haven't yet filed, and if we're doing a 1040, you know, relatively easy return or something with the W-2 mortgage interest, you know, how most of the 140 million returns look, the IRS is ready to receive those. They'll get those processed electronically. And where before, if we look back at the 2011 and 2010 filing season, if you filed your return electronically on a Monday or Tuesday, chances are you'd have your refund direct deposited into your account within a week. And what the IRS ran into and what they discovered, really thankfully, is that there was so much identity theft and so many fraudulent returns that were being filed. I think I just read something where they found nearly 4 million returns that they caught internally before they issued these identity stolen fraudulent returns. That what they're doing now is they're waiting at least a week before they send back the electronic refund. And in some cases, they're holding them for up to 21 days just to verify that it is, in fact, a return filed by that taxpayer and not someone who tried to steal the identity.
Boy, there are really two sides to the convenience of electronic filing then, isn't there, aren't there?
Yeah, there really are. And I think the good still far outweighs the bad. I mean, the good side is there's certainly no more mathematical errors, which was always the biggest cause of any you know, notices and things like that came out. So all those are gone. And I still think it's very safe and very secure to file their return electronically. In general, I'm still a big fan of that process.
You know, I think it was just this past week that the folks at Social Security indicated they're going to require that their payments, their monthly payments, be deposited electronically into the accounts of those on Social Security because it costs a buck to send the checks by mail, but only 10 cents to do it the other way. Is there any discussion about IRS demanding it be done that way, too?
Well, Congress has mandated, they mandated probably 6 or 7 years ago that they wanted a percentage filed electronically. And I can't recall on top of my head if the goal was 70% or maybe even as high as 90%. But what they've done is they've required every preparer who signs and prepares more than 10 income tax returns to electronically file the returns for their clients. Now, I have a handful of clients who They just don't want to do that. They don't trust the electronics yet, and they want to file a paper return. And the IRS allows them to do that, but there's also another form to waive the electronic filing requirement so that they can file on paper. So they're certainly encouraging and pushing everyone that they can to file electronically. But there's still a pretty good percentage who file on paper.
Yeah. Outfits like TurboTax, as you've indicated, are up to speed with regard to 2012. A question about using programs like this. When does a tax become too complicated to use those commercial products?
Well, I would say it's really going to depend on the comfort level of the individual. I mean, I know people who, you know, manage their own money up to very high dollars of wealth. And then I know some other people who, as soon as they get $1,000 ready to invest, they hire someone to help them do that. So it's very much a personal decision and a personal comfort level. When I see people really have the need to go out and hire a professional to help them is when they start getting into some areas maybe related to, you know, purchasing some rental properties or entering into another business venture where, you know, you can go out to Missouri's website and form an LLC and, you know, for about $45 and 20 minutes and a few clicks, you can go out there and form a legal Missouri entity. And it's easy to do, but if you have two owners in that entity and now your tax is a partnership, partnership taxation is a level and a brings about some opportunities and some difficulties that I tell most people, don't try to do those on your own. You know, it's when you start a business or buy some property and you're trying to figure out the best depreciation method, that's really the time to sit down with somebody and figure out what's the best way to do this.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the specifics here. I did some research prior to this program, and some of the things that I've run across I'll bring up, and you can explain them for folks. Several inflation adjustments, as I understand it, this time around. Personal exemptions are going to increase. Standard deductions are going to rise. Tax brackets will widen, all to keep pace with inflation. Is this something new?
No, they've pretty much always adjusted the tax brackets and the exemption amounts for inflation. I think this past year they went up about $100. Although one thing that is new on the inflation adjustment side is that the alternative minimum tax, which we've all come to complain so much about, and just how they ever made it as complicated as it is just something that only Congress is good at, I suppose. But now they're beginning in 2013, they'll be adjusting the starting point for the alternative minimum tax brackets as well. And the hope there is to keep fewer taxpayers from having to go through that calculation of the AMT. Because it wasn't indexed for the last 20 years, each year more and more people were subject to it. So now they hope by indexing it, they can keep it really only affecting the people that it was intended to originally.
I think we'd better do once again what we have done many, many times on our discussions, and that is just really explain to folks what that AMT, the alternative minimum tax, is and how they're likely to be impacted.
Right. The alternative minimum tax is a second tax calculation that, in general, what it does, it has a lower rate. The highest AMT rate is only 28%. However, the calculation of the income subject to that lower rate is a much different calculation. And for example, when you go to calculate your alternative minimum taxable income, you don't get any benefit for your exemptions and for having kids and the dependents. You also get no benefit for any of the state income taxes you pay or any of the real estate tax or personal property taxes that you pay. So it's a lower rate of tax, but it's applied to a greater amount of income. And when that happens, there's a bubble area, I call it, and I see it most often affect those people with on the low side, between maybe $100,000 and $150,000 in income, depending on how many kids they have. And then once income gets up over about $700,000 or $800,000, they tend to be out of the AMT because they have so much income subject to that 35% bracket that they have a higher regular tax than they do alternative minimum tax. So it is a second separate calculation. The nice thing about all the TurboTax programs and things like that is that it'll do that calculation for you automatically, and then you'll pay whichever amount is higher, either the regular tax or the alternative minimum tax. And you know, Don, it's really one of the reasons why I'm such a fan of, you know, using these programs and not trying to do your return by hand, because to go through the form 6251, which is where we calculate that AMT tax, it's quite a process. It's not easy to do by hand.
This is something that Congress has to patch every year, isn't it?
Well, up until this new January 2nd law, that was true. And as part of the, you know, that end of the year fiscal cliff that we were running into and all of the tax changes that, you know, will they get extended and what will the dividend rate be, one of the very good things that came out of all that negotiation is the permanent fix on that annual AMT exemption. So now we know for all years going forward that that AMT exemption on a married filing joint return, which in essence it's kind of the standard deduction for the alternative minimum tax, for on a married return it's $78,750, and each year that will be adjusted for inflation. And that's one of those things where every year they threaten that it, you know, it'll expire this year and we won't know what it is, and every year they had to patch it. Well, again, as part of that January 2nd law change, that American Taxpayer Relief Act of 2012, they made that exemption amount permanent, and they will index it for inflation. So at least now we have some certainty with regard to the AMT tax, and we won't have to worry every year whether or not we'll get a fix or not.
There's ongoing talk about tax reform and the fact that there might be some activity in this area over the next year or so. I wonder if the AMT would survive any tax reform.
I hope it doesn't. You know, I hope it's one of those things that does go away, and let's try to bring some simplicity back to the code if that's at all possible. And I really, it's time, Don. I mean, but right now we still operate under the Internal Revenue Code of 1986 as amended, and there are tens of thousands of pages, you know, in that original code and the amendments. Well, before the 86 code, we had the 1954 code, so it lasted, you know, just over 30 years or so. And 1986 to today, we're coming up on that 30-year mark. So it's time for a good rewrite and reboot of the whole system. We'll see how it goes. But I really think the best chance to get that done is the second term of a president. And that's what we have now. So maybe we will get some, you know, a good rewrite that hopefully brings some simplicity back into the system.
But, of course, it would also require some cooperation on the part of Congress and both parties in Congress. And that has, I think we can say, has been somewhat problematical in recent years.
Yeah, that's for sure. But, you know, I mean, we just look at the 10 or 15 different deductions and credits that are out there for the tax benefits for education, for example. And, you know, that would be an area that both sides could look at that and say, guys, do we need a dozen different income tax and credit-related benefits for education? Let's just have one. You know, let's make this easier for people to understand. Because that, you know, and I mentioned before, when should somebody go out and hire a professional or at least, you know, stop trying to do the form by hand and buy the software? If you have a child in college, just navigating the different benefits of, do I take the lifetime learning or the American opportunity or which credit and which deduction and 529 plans and all the things that are out there, you know, I'd hate to try to do one of those by hand, and this is what I do for a living.
Yeah. Well, sometimes some of us get a headache just even talking about it. But,
I hope I'm not giving you
that. No, but it really it is kind of mind-numbing to think about some of these things. We're talking with Lance Weiss, CPA with SFW Partners, LLC. We're talking taxes, and it's really an opportunity for you to ask your questions, your tax questions of Lance Weiss. We'll encourage your calls at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air, or you can also reach us through Facebook. Good opportunity to get those tax questions asked and answered, and it's a good time to do it, too. We're going to be snowed in for a while, it looks like. Time to get out those records and start thinking taxes. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back to our conversation with CPA Lance Weiss. We're talking taxes and prepared to take your questions, your tax questions. I have an email already from Samantha. Lance, let's take her question. She writes, 4 years ago, my husband was not paid for his last 2 months of work at a job. The Department of Labor this year required the employer to pay us the money plus interest. 4 years ago, we paid taxes on the money we didn't get because it was on the W-2. This year, we didn't get a W-2 from his employer. The Department of Labor has asked them to send it, but we haven't received anything. What do we do?
Oh, my.
Don't Talk about mind-numbing.
Yeah, and, you know, that's one of those things where, Don, this is why they call what we do the practice of accounting. So I would suggest, you know, hopefully the business who is ordered to pay the amount will correct their filings and issue out an amended W-2 from, well, although that was 4 years ago. Was it 4 years ago?
4 years ago, yeah.
Yeah, well, see, with 4 years ago, that statute may have already closed, depending on when that return was filed. So I don't even know that an amended W-2 would help that much from 4 years ago. How I would report that would to, first of all, reflect the amount of the wage that came in on the 2012, you know, year. And then I would show as a separate line item amount already subject to tax and show that amount as a negative so that the only amount that would be subject to income tax on this year's return would be the interest income amount. Because they still haven't paid tax on the interest, and that is income earned from whatever source derived, so it is subject to tax. But I think I'd do a couple of things. I would certainly report the total amount so that they would match that up with any other reporting that might eventually make it to the IRS. But then tell the IRS, hey, listen, we've already paid tax on this amount, so I'm going to back that off as a negative number, and then leaving only the interest amount to be subject to tax.
Would it make any sense in Samantha's case to go to the local IRS office and go face-to-face with someone down there to get it worked out before just trying to do all this by mail?
You know, the IRS has some help locations like that kind of all over the place. What the agent would require before they would tell you how to do it would be to say, well, bring me the records that show that 4 years ago the total was already taxed. So you'll have to bring in the W-2 that would show the total amount of income that was reported 4 years ago, and then all the canceled checks and all the bank records that show, listen, this says that $20,000 was paid. However, here are all the canceled checks and all of our bank records that only show $18,000 came in. Mm-hmm. So before someone at the service center could ever be authorized to help you and file that official IRS return like that, they would probably want a lot more records than what an individual doing their own honest return on their own can do.
Ah, okay. Let's take a call. I hope I have the name pronounced correct. It looks like Giant from St. Louis. Please correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you pronounced it right.
Oh, great.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm gonna make it a real effective question. My own business. It's a small business. My question to you is that I want to pay myself a salary. How much salary is the most appropriate so that IRS doesn't say you're paying yourself too little or too high?
Okay. So now part of that answer will depend on how the business is organized. And if it is a Schedule C sole proprietorship, or an LLC taxed as a partnership, or a corporation, either an S-corp or a C-corp. Do you know how you're organized to do business?
Yes, it is an S-corp, and 100% okay. As myself.
Okay. So you have an S-corporation where you own 100% of the stock. And this is one of those very high-risk audit areas because the IRS and the taxpayers who are in a situation, you know, as you are, recognize that the income that flows through to you from the business aspect of it, from that page one business income, is not subject to the payroll tax. However, if you pay yourself on a W-2 and take out a salary, it is subject to all the payroll taxes.
Yeah.
So there's an incentive of the individual not to take out a big salary, but then there are the rules that the IRS has that say you must take out a reasonable salary. And what the IRS really never does for us or anyone else is come out with a hard and fast rule of what is reasonable. So it's hard to tell and there is no safe harbor. So that's the first answer to the question. So then you start to figure out, well, what is reasonable in my industry, in my business? And what I tell my clients that are organized as you are, and maybe they're attorneys or maybe they're doctors, and every penny of their income is because of their labor and their work, Well, with that fact pattern, you would need a very high W-2 from a percentage standpoint compared to what would flow through as page one income. However, if that same individual has a different type of company where maybe they have some patents or some other product lines or other materials that they, you know, where they have the capital invested and they're operating another type of business, where most of the income from the business doesn't come from their labor, it comes from the other assets that the corporation also owns and you have management over. In that case, you could get by with a much smaller amount of W-2, and if you're simply the manager of those particular products or patents or whatever they might be, you would look to what would you pay someone to come in and manage that for you, and that would be the reasonable W-2. Now, rare is the case that we have clean facts, that clean of a fact, going both ways. But, you know, other than to say each case and each fact pattern has to stand on its own, and the IRS would rather see a higher number on the W-2 than a lower number, I don't know how much more specific guidance I can really give.
Hope that's helpful. Thank you so much for the call. Thank you so much. Related to business also is this note from Isaac, who's asking, I was self-employed, but I'm now the full owner of an LLC. Are there differences in filing a 1099 form?
Okay. So if you are the sole owner of an LLC, then that LLC is taxed as the entity that owns it. So if Isaac is the 100% owner of the LLC, it will still be reported on his Schedule C of his 1040. If Isaac is another owner in the LLC, where now we have a two-person LLC, the default tax classification would be a partnership. However, the LLC could make an S-corp election or elect to be taxed as a C-corporation. So the LLCs have tremendous flexibility in that area from an income tax reporting standpoint. Now, his question specifically dealt with, tell me about the 1099s and how does that change anything? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't change a thing. The 1099 requirements are identical across the board for any trade or business. So before, when it operated as a Schedule C, as a sole proprietorship business, he needed to issue a 1099 to every vendor who was not an incorporated entity when those payments exceeded $600, except for any amount that was paid to an attorney. They have to get one even if only $1 is paid to the attorney. Attorneys have to always get 1099s.
We should remind people, too, to be very aware of those 1099s, because a lot of times this tax, this information comes in and people don't understand them, and I understand, just throw them away.
Yeah, and that's really dangerous to do, Don, and even you know, the 1099s that come in from some of the schools and the colleges and maybe some scholarship programs. This past year, my daughter had a little bit of scholarship money come in, and it was on the wrong box of the 1099. So I called the organization who issued the 1099, and I said, hey, guys, this should be in the other income box, not the non-employee compensation box. And they said, oh, my gosh, you're right. We're sorry. We'll reissue it. So even those that come from, you know, large organizations, there can be errors on them.
Yeah, well, that's a good thing that you are in the business you're in to have caught that. Most people probably would not have.
Yeah, I don't think I was their first call because they knew pretty quickly what I was talking about.
Really, really.
Yeah.
Back to the phones. Let's bring in Ed calling from St. Louis. Ed, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Thanks. This will seem a little bit like a technical question, but Mr. Weiss will know the answer. This week, I made a loan to a young man, and we signed a promissory note. And over the next two years, he's going to send me the same amount of money at the end of the month. I had him go online and amortize that thing, and I see amortize it between the principal and the interest. And my question is, because I want to be able to tell him, how much does the interest have to be before he has to send me a 1099 next year? Because he doesn't know. He's got a lawn business. Are you with
okay.
me?
Yeah, so he has a lawn business, and he needs to send you the 1099. You know, The rules for banks to issue out a 1099, I believe, is as low as $10. So, I think, but I, you know, you've caught me a little bit cold here, and I don't know the answer on that with the top from the top of my head. It's certainly over $600. There's no doubt about it that the 1099 would have to be issued, and I would say there would never be any harm in him going ahead to do the 1099 anyway. And that form's going to come in on a 1099-INT, and so I would say, you know, better safe than sorry. And what I can do on that, too, if you could give Mary some contact information, I can look up that number for you and then let you know.
Can I just say something here?
Sure.
I just want to say, really, that was a very good explanation, and I've listened to this show for a number of years, and I happen to be a former certified public accountant, and you are the most knowledgeable person that I've ever heard on the radio on this subject.
I really do appreciate that, although I know there are many of us in St. Louis who... there are people I call with questions often, but I certainly do appreciate that.
And we appreciate your listening, Ed. And Lance, he's absolutely right. He's absolutely right. You're the best.
Well, you know, this it's more than a full-time job, I can tell you that.
Well, it is, and I just marvel. You know, you talk about a 70,000-page tax code, and a guy like yourself can sit here and take questions from all over the place and be right on target most of the time, if not all of the time.
I'm never afraid to say I don't know the answer, because sometimes there's just too much in there to know.
Yeah, well, that's a good idea, too. Let's take another call. John in Webster Groves has been waiting. Go ahead, John.
Hi. For the last several years, I've had a small income and haven't had to file an income tax. But I just heard that if I do file, I might be able to get a refund on my real estate taxes. And I live in Webster Groves, so they're pretty high. And that I can perhaps file back years and get refunds for that. Is this all true, and how far back can I go?
Yes, John, it is true that the refunds, however, wouldn't come from the federal government. They'd come from the state of Missouri, and the state of Missouri has what they used to call them the circuit breaker credits. I'm not sure if they've changed the name on those, but you can go back up to 3 years. So certainly go ahead and file the 2012 return to get that, and then you could go back and do a 2011 and a 2010 also. And you know what? We're still early enough. You could go back and do the 9 as well. So you could go back and do a calendar year 2009, 10, 11, and now do the 12. And hopefully that'll work out where you do get a refund.
Well, thank you.
John, thanks so much for the call. We have some lines open, 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can email us at talk@stlpublicradio.org, send us a tweet, or reach us through Facebook. We're talking with Lance Weiss, CPA with SFW Partners, LLC, and obviously we're talking about taxes. As we wait for some more calls, Lance, let me just bring up a couple of issues that people may be wondering about. One is capital gains. There have been some changes there, right?
Yeah, there certainly have been some changes there, although, again, as part of that fiscal cliff negotiation, nobody was really sure where that capital gain rate would fall out. And there is a new 20% capital gain rate. However, it only affects those that new 20% rate only affects those individuals if you're single, when your income is over $400,000. And if you're married, the rate goes up if your income's over $450,000. And those are the 2013 rules. So for 2012, we have the same rules that we've had for, a good 3 or 4 years now. And what those are is that if your income falls in either the 10 or the 15% tax bracket, then you have a 0% capital gains rate. And up until any amount over that, your capital gains rate on the long-term capital gains is only 15% for 2012.
So this is quite a boon for the high-income folks.
Yeah, there were a couple of things in this tax law that surprised me for the high-income folks. One is, you know, what they did here with the capital gains. But even more so of a surprise was what they did with the dividend rates. And to keep those at 20% for those with incomes over $450,000, we all, you know, in the CPA community, I'm not going to say all, but certainly most of us, I think, expected that rate to go up to the ordinary income tax rate of up to 39.6%. But instead, they kept that dividend rate down to 20%, even for those in the highest tax bracket. So there were, that was a pretty big surprise that I saw in this new tax law.
How about for the rest of us, those in the lower tax brackets? Any advantages for us with all of this?
Yeah, there were some real good changes in that. They were extended through 2013. If you give your bank back to the home, or you give your bank back to the home, you give your home back to the bank, and you have this qualified principal residence exclusion, that was something that was set to expire, but now that's been extended through 2013. For all of the teachers and educators that are out there, their deduction for up to $250 for all the job-related classroom-type supplies, those are deductible also. Another good change was the mortgage insurance premium, you know, that PMI insurance that so many people pay. Mm-hmm. That remains as a deduction as mortgage interest through 2013, so that was a good change. We have the tax credit stayed up there at $1,000 for any children that are under the age of 17, so that was a good change. From the education standpoint, the American Opportunity Tax Credit has been extended all the way through 2017, which was, that was a little bit unexpected as well. I thought that one might expire. So there were, you know, all in all, a few hundred tax changes that came into play with this January 2nd law change, but there were many out there for, you know, the for those with incomes below either that $250,000 or $450,000 threshold.
Any particular advantages for those at the poverty line or below?
Well, they did continue to have the earned income credit. It stayed up at a higher level, and it's also refundable, and that's also extended through 2017. So, yeah, they did keep what they call the enhanced earned income credit in the tax code.
And there's a good chance that whatever we're talking about today will be different a year from today when we're talking, Lance, because
I think some of these, you know, some of the things that have been extended through 2017 and even through 2013, you know, with all the acrimony that's up there in the House and the Senate and everywhere else in Washington, if something is in the law for that long already, I don't see them reopening that box to fight over something else. They have enough current issues to fight about.
Time will tell. Have to take another break. We'll do that now. Those on the line, please wait. We'll be right back with Lance Weiss, CPA. We're talking taxes. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back. I'm Don Marsh, and if you're just joining us, my guest by phone is Lance Weiss, CPA. We're talking taxes. Let's go right back to the phones. Lots of callers. We'll begin with Donna calling from Crestwood. Go ahead, Donna.
Hi. I was wondering, it seems like most years I always get my 1099 divs and stuff like before February 1st, but this year for some reason my broker says they're not even going to mail them until the end of February. So I'm dying to start doing my taxes, and I started just using my year-end statement, which supposedly told the amount of dividends I had for the year and qualified dividends, but my husband's like, wants to wait for the 1099 div just in case there's a discrepancy. What do you think?
Yeah, I would say you're better off waiting until you get the 1099 div, because the sort of discrepancy that you might get would be something in a money market fund. They might call that interest on the statement that comes out from the broker on the year end, but then when whatever brokerage company gets the 1099 from whatever money market fund they've bought into, part of that might be reclassed as a dividend. So I think you'd be, you know, it's great to do the estimate and have an idea of what you might get back or what you owe, but I think it is smarter to wait until you get the 1099 div as well.
Okay. What isn't there some rule that they're supposed to mail that earlier?
Well, you know, I thought it was February 15th.
Oh, okay.
But what some brokerage houses are doing is they're sending out version 1 by February 15th, but then they say, don't use this because we're still waiting for other information, and it could be February 28th. But I think there were some exemptions were granted out until the end of February to issue those 1099s.
I see. Well, thank you.
Lance, didn't it used to be the end of January these things had to be?
For years and years, Don, it was. It was always January 31st. Everything had to be out to the individuals. But what happened was is the IRS started to require more information reported on the 1099s. So what we see now from the brokerage companies is any stock that was purchased in 2011 or later, the brokerage houses are also telling the IRS what the basis is in those assets and what the actual gain amount is on those sales. So as they, you know, made more heavy the burden on the brokerage houses, they gave them a little more time to make sure they get them done accurately.
We've got to get this thing simplified, Lance.
There's a lot out there, and they're trying to get as much as they can electronically, but it'll be a process.
Sure, no doubt. Back to the phones, and Jared in St. Charles, thank you for waiting. Jared, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks. I'm a second bachelor student, so I was got my first bachelor's. I went out to work and decided to change my career field, and I was I've been filing my taxes the past 2 years and realized that there really isn't that, or at least that I know of, no necessary benefit in terms of lifetime learning credit or anything like that. Am I missing anything?
You know, I would think you could still qualify for the lifetime learning credit as long as you're a full-time student, because it is anyone out there who is an eligible student should be able to get the lifetime learning credit.
Okay.
What is the lifetime learning credit?
Well, there are two main credits out there for education benefits. One's called the American Opportunity Credit, and that credit at $4,000 of tuition, it's a $2,500 credit. The lifetime learning credit is a 20% credit on up to $10,000 of tuition. So it's not quite as beneficial, but it's available for a longer period of time.
I see. Okay, back to the phones. Once again, Colette in St. Louis, it's your turn. Go ahead. You're on the air with Lance Weiss.
Hello. I was calling because, unfortunately, I had to foreclose on my home this year, and I just received the 1099 form for it, and it states what I owed and then what they suggest that we sell it for. And I have no idea, how will that affect my taxes this year? Will I have to pay taxes on the difference of what they're saying it appraises for now versus what I owed? I just have no idea.
Well, the difference between those two numbers will be what the bank seems to be calling the cancellation of indebtedness income. So, you know, whatever that shortfall is, and let's say that it was, you know, $15,000 or whatever number it might have been, just so I can kind of walk through an example. They're saying that $15,000 would be the cancellation of indebtedness income. Now, as part of the fiscal cliff that we almost went over here at the end of the year, the law extended the tax-free nature of that cancellation of indebtedness income. So you won't have to pay income tax on that if that forgiveness qualifies under all these different rules. And the main different rule that catches people, that prevents it from being tax-free, is whether or not you ever did a cash-out refinancing since you bought the home. So if you bought the home 15 years ago but refinanced it 5 or 10 years ago and took some cash out to either pay off credit cards or buy a car or whatever you might have done with that cash-out money, then the amount of that cash-out amount would not be eligible for that exclusion from income. So whether or not that income is taxed will depend on if you ever did that cash out refinancing. But if it was the first mortgage on your house and you never took any more money out and all you ever did was, you know, pay the payments but then got underwater and it went back to the bank, then that would be tax free. And the form you would use for the IRS to show that would be a form 982. And that form will have some other additional comments on, you know, this cash out refinancing and some of the provisions that can make it tax free.
Colette, I hope that helps. Thanks so much for your call. Let's continue with property here with Jim calling from Columbia, Missouri. He has a property question. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi. I have a about 5 years ago, I sold a piece of rental property and carried a second on the property, and then last year the the owner went through bankruptcy and the property was foreclosed. So I didn't know if that's just a capital loss and I'm limited to the $3,000 a year cap on that, or can I write that off against ordinary income?
When the house was foreclosed, did you get the property back, or did the property go back to the bank where he had the first?
It went back to the bank.
Okay, so you had a note. You were receiving some payments on the note, and then he went through bankruptcy, and then whatever was left due on your note just kind of went poof, I guess would be the technical term there.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So when you were picking up the income on that installment note, were you picking it up as an installment sale income, or did you pay tax on it the whole thing when it was entered into?
I paid tax as I was receiving.
Okay, so you paid tax on it as you were receiving it. So
yes.
So yeah, what's going to happen here then? Because you were paying tax on it as you were receiving the money, you won't get to deduct the full loss on that note because you haven't picked it up yet in income. There is a worksheet to go through, though, to see how much of it would either be deductible. And I guess since you didn't get the house back at all, yeah, there could be a little bit of a loss on that note. So I would the way to estimate the number would be to calculate how much basis you had left in that note that didn't get paid, and then that amount should be the amount of your loss on either the 12 or 13 tax return, depending on when the bankruptcy happened and you lost that value. And then that loss should be treated as what's called a 1231 loss because it was a rental property you had, correct?
Yes,
Yeah, so because it relates back to a rental property, that loss should be what's called a Section 1231 loss. You're going to want to use a Form 4797 to report that.
Okay.
And that form and the instructions should walk you through that treatment.
Oh, great. Okay.
Okay.
Hey, thanks.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks very much for your call. I have a couple of email questions here, Lance. I think we can probably dispense with rather quickly. My father moved out of an assisted living facility last year and moved in with my brother. He's paying him $2,000 a month that goes toward living expenses. Does my brother have to claim this as income?
I'm going to say the answer on that one is no. The $2,000 a month would be something similar to that's what he's paying. Well, $2,000 a month is a pretty big number, though.
Yeah.
I would figure out the expenses that he's incurring to have him live there. So, you know, certainly if the $2,000 was all going towards his medication and food and rent, but utilities and other living expenses, then what his father's doing there is just helping contribute to the cost of owning the household. And it doesn't sound like we have a formal rental arrangement here where he's picking up rental income and would have to, you know, deduct the expenses against that. I would say it's more likely just a sharing of living expenses.
Okay, another quick question. If you perform a service 1 year but don't get paid for it until the next, how do you report it?
You would not pay income tax on that until you collected the money.
Another quick question. You win a significant amount of money as a legal award and a lawsuit. How are you taxed on that?
Generally as ordinary income. However, if the lawsuit related to discrimination lawsuit, or, well, you know, there's one other exclusion on that, Don. I think it relates to damage to your physical body. I think there's a little bit of an exclusion on that as well. So we would need to have a little more fact about what the lawsuit covered. But in general, the IRS has a rule that says everything is income unless we tell you it's not. So chances are the lawsuit proceeds would be taxable.
Okay. Back to the phones. Royal and Baldwin, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I know in 2011, the state of Missouri allowed the food pantry tax credit to expire. Well, last month, I had heard they were going to renew that. I don't know if they did or not. And if they did, is that retroactive to cover 2012 or not?
Well, the tax credits for the food pantry and those sort of donations will depend on the individual organizations. So your best bet would be to contact some of those. And Missouri has a pretty good website under their economic development section. I'm pretty sure these fall under. And some of the food pantries, if they're here locally in the St. Louis area or in the Kansas City metropolitan area, you'll get back a credit on those for up to 50% of the amount donated. But if you go to some of the out-state food pantries, the credit that comes back from those can be up to 70% of the amount donated. And it very much depends on, did that charity get all the right paperwork in, and did they qualify, and do they have those credits that have been allocated to them? But there are still some of those out there for 2012, and well, 2013 now, because the 12 years over.
Thanks for the call. Lance, did I read someplace that there have been some changes in cash and non-cash contributions this time?
Well, the IRS has cracked down quite a bit on, you know, on the contributions and what's deductible and what isn't deductible. The big tax court case that they won in 2012 deals with the letters that come back from the charities thanking the donor for the gifts. And what those letters now must affirmatively state in order to get the deduction is that no goods or services were provided to the donor in exchange or because of this gift. So we need very specific language in these thank you letters now in order to take the income tax deduction.
Ah, okay. I will try another phone call. Dennis and Baldwin, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I have a question regarding who claims an exemption for a student that may have scholarships and has worked, so has provided some of their support. Parents have provided some support, but and then I guess is there a question in terms of whether they might declare their legal residence with the parents? Or maybe their residence is being at the college and does things like health insurance and car insurance or other things factor into who can claim the exemption for the amount of support provided?
This is okay. In a divorce situation?
I'm sorry?
In a divorce situation?
No, this will be a student,
okay.
Son or daughter.
Yeah. The big question here is whether or not the kids claim themselves or if the parents claim themselves. And the
right.
Test on the kids that are between the ages of 18 and 24 isn't so much who provides the support, but how much earned income does the child have. And if the child has earned income greater than half of their support, then they are deemed to be providing half of their own support, even if all that earned income goes into IRAs or you know, goes out for their spring break trips or whatever it might be, then doesn't go directly for their support. So we need to go through the worksheets that say how much support was there in total for the child, and to go through that calculation, you look at all of your household costs. The education costs do come in. I believe health insurance does as well. And then if their earned income is greater than half of that number, then the child will claim himself. So it's not so much who's paying all those support tests, it's how much is the earned income.
Well, thank you for the call. We've only got about 45 seconds left. I don't have time for another call.
Just one more on that.
Yeah.
It's the publication 970 is the best source for where that worksheet is. So IRS Pub 970 will help that gentleman out with their worksheet.
Okay, well, this has been a very fast hour, Lance Weiss. I want to thank you so much, and sorry for folks who are still waiting to have questions answered. We just don't have time to continue, unfortunately. But, Lance, thank you, as usual. Great job and filling people in on some of the more obscure sometimes tax issues that pop up. We thank you for being with us and hope you can get through this bad weather in good shape.
Yep, thank you so much. I was going to ask the caller from Columbia how snowed in they were. I think they were supposed to get a foot or so.
Yeah, I imagine they've probably gotten quite a bit by now.
Yep.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Folks, join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, and he'll talk with a cast member from the production of The Book of Mormon at the Fox, and about Briefs, a festival of short LGBT plays. Also, Jim Althoff will talk with blues musician Ricky Skaggs. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about current issues pertaining to the law with a panel of legal experts. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Spencer Reed, and Drew Becker. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.